Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this special edition of General Talk as the Army Benevolent Fund marks the extraordinary story of a day trip to Sarajevo by the regimental band of the Kurdistan Guards, when the United Nations were beaten at football 30 years ago on the 20th of March 1994. A tale of peace. It was fine in Sarajevo, see you in Calgary. Yugoslavia closes the 1984 Winter Olympics. Within 7 years, the Federal Republic, largely held together by its charismatic leader, Josip Tito, who died 4 years previously, began to crumble and separate into ethnic warring factions based on the Croat, Serb and Muslim populations of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Sarajevo was besieged in total for 1,425 days, the longest siege of a capital city in modern history. Almost 14,000 were killed, including 5,500 civilians. Former chief correspondent of the BBC, Kate Ady.
Oh, under siege, grim, dank, dark, and isolated. And by that time, absolutely wrecked and knocked about place. Ruins everywhere, no shops, everything gone years ago, rubble, and a sense of it's kind of sense of poverty.
On the 24th of January 1994, Lieutenant General Sir Michael Rose, the no-nonsense Kurdistan Guards officer who commanded the SAS in both the Iranian embassy siege and the Falklands War, succeeded Lieutenant General Brinkman of the Belgian Army as commander of Bosnia-Herzegovina Command of the United Nations Protection Force, or UNPROFOR. Major General Peter Williams, then commanding 1st Battalion Kurdistan Guards Armoured Infantry Battle Group on Operation Grapple 3, in the winter of 1993-94, outlines the key role of the British military presence in Bosnia at the time.
But the striking thing about the British contribution and us as the British battalion when we were there was that we were really the only manoeuvrable, redeployable troops in theatre. Other nations were content that their troops were where they were, other peacekeeping contingents. No one else had the ability to put together a squadron or a company and redeploy it to meet the new requirements that Commander might have had. And so Michael Rose was determined to shift the story in Sarajevo, and in order to do so, to make use of the British troops that were in theatre. And we spent a lot of time shaking the kaleidoscope, as it were, to make companies and recce platoons and things available to move elsewhere. And this was a classic case of going where the general wished to put emphasis, as it were, on the battlefield.
On the 9th of February 1994, the United Nations persuaded warring factions to agree to a ceasefire in Sarajevo and to a total exclusion zone for heavy weapons with a radius of 20 kilometres. General Rose describes the enormous effort it took to secure that peace.
It took a great deal of work on behalf of the peacekeepers. NATO were determined to use that venue as a way of going to war for the first time in its history, and they fought tooth and nail against the peacekeepers not to allow that cessation of hostilities to occur. And yet NATO was determined to go to war on that basis. It took a great deal of work for the peacekeepers to actually impose a peace.
Six aircraft were in flagrant breach of the NATO ultimatum, and not only that, they were engaged, from what I understand, actually in attacking targets on the ground. They were warned about their activity, and if they should continue this activity, From what I hear, they were told they would be shot down. They continued with their attack missions, and they were duly the first pair were shot down, and 2 minutes later the next pair was still continuing and they were also shot down. Now that is first information. As you know, things never quite work out when you get the full report, but that is information I've received. And I don't believe that it would have the slightest effect on what we're doing here, which of course is feeding 2.7 million people in central Bosnia and trying to establish a peace process, which hitherto has gone well over the last 14 days.
General Rose describing the Banja Luka incident, the first active combat action in NATO's history, when six Republika Srpska Air Force single-seat light attack jets were engaged and four of them shot down by NATO while violating the no-fly zone. The message was clear. The peacekeepers meant business. Ceasefires, when they happen, are bewildering. It is strange how we humans quickly adjust the restrictions of war. My recollections of peace, when it came, was akin to learning to walk again. Strange at first, freedom was quickly relearned. But as the saying goes, it is folly to fly before you can run, and any enthusiasms have to be constrained to avert disaster. What better way to build a peace, the general and his interpreter, Nick Illich, concluded, than to organise a football match? Major General Peter Williams.
I think my first reaction was rather like that of many people. It was slightly incredulous that this could possibly happen, given that Sarajevo was a very, you know, there might be a ceasefire of sorts going on, but might this not present a provocation to the Serbs on the high ground around and about?
Kate Adie.
When you first heard about the football match, the UN team against FK Sarajevo, what was your first reaction?
So none of us were surprised by oddities, I have to say. We'd seen a great number of them. The idea of a football match, we initially thought was good-o, because football was hugely popular in the area. I mean, the stadium had its own team. It was a Sarajevo team.
Sarajevo.
And absolutely, it seemed, well, not a bad idea, except it seemed a bit crazy because we weren't quite sure if anybody would turn up. You know, the idea of gathering a crowd was tricky. What was going to happen. And also, I think the very fact that it was going to be a game is a difficult thing after so much conflict, with things still unsettled. So, knowing Mike Rose, we knew, I think all of us, the press, that it would happen. He was a tough man. He's very stylish, no doubt about it, and very much a man to lead from the front.
General Sir Michael Rose.
Despite the fact that we had the ceasefire, you're running with this ball, as it were, excuse the pun, of the football match, but you don't know when it's going to happen, you don't know how it's going to come about. When did this time come when you said, right, we can do this?
Well, it came about because the ceasefire was obviously holding, that Karadzic had signed up to this, Izetbegovic and his henchman Ganic had took some persuading, because again they were very against having a return to normality. But such was the enthusiasm of the people, because of course by then we were telling the people of Sarajevo that this was likely to happen, or hoped that it would happen, that in the end the pressure became too great for them not to allow that to happen. Of course the risk was that the Serbs were double crossing us, because the football ground is exactly underneath the one of the Serb positions, and they could have sniped down or fired mortars straight into the football arena if they'd wanted to. We had to keep our fingers crossed, and indeed our toes crossed, throughout the football match, hoping that they would hold the agreement that we'd made with them to allow that football to happen.
What was your game plan if they had that?
Well, there was no plan B. But then you can't always have a plan B in life. You have to take a risk from time to time. And the benefits of doing this were so great that they massively outweighed any possible risk.
Whose idea was it to have the Kosovan Guards band to march out on parade?
I can't quite remember where that came from, but the colonel of the Kosovan Guards was a great friend of mine, General Willie Rice. I think it might have come out in a conversation with him, that, you know, there always is a band on these occasions, and the idea that the Kosovan Guards band, of course I'm a Kosovan myself, although of course I was in the role of a UN commander. One day the Kosovan Guards band were playing, outside Buckingham Palace. The next day, literally within 24 hours, they were playing in front of, in the middle of this besieged and derelict city, amongst the ruins, under the guns of the Serbs and the Muslims as well. It was a kind of a natural progression. But everyone was behind it, everyone was very supportive, and it worked absolutely perfectly.
General Peter Williams.
I understand that somehow General Rose and the UN staff convinced the Bosnian Serbs that that this football match was going to go ahead, and it was not to be interfered with.
Stan Jackson, Coldstream Guards, then senior drum major of the Household Division, whose job it would be to lead the Coldstream Guards band out onto the football stadium.
Everything happened so quickly. It was very short notice. I remember coming home from work and saying to Sandra, my wife, "Oh, I'm going out to Sarajevo."
Kevin Coates, then band sergeant major of the regimental band of the Coldstream Guards.
Phone call to the band office saying they would like to take the band to Sarajevo, which we had to laugh about, but it was, it was meant to be. So then, as you know, the band's not combatants, so all the gear we needed for to go out there, we had to source. So things like the blue UN berries. So we had to send people down to Bicester. We were told to take as little as possible to walk on with things. Obviously, we had all the larger instruments like tubas, so it was all turn up at Bryce Norton with everything in your hand luggage and walk onto the plane, big pile, strap it down, and away we went.
We went straight into Hercules. And for a lot of the guys in the regimental band, it was a bit of an eye-opener. And we got in there, and we're all in combat suits with our UN berries and brassards on. And the old canvas bucket seats, that was a bit of an eye-opener for them, bless them. Yeah. The toilet in the corner that we could all share and watch each other, which was lovely. And I remember having travelled in Hercules a few times and through service, as we all did, I had the old Walkman with the inner earphones, pop your Amplivox on over the top. Well, of course, those lads were gobsmacked because they didn't realise it was going to be like that. They only had the little pop the things in their ear, so everyone was deafened. And then when I climbed up on the netting, the cargo netting, to get my head down, everyone was like, what's he doing? Get him down. He's trying to kill himself. But it was good fun. But no, they were brilliant. The lads in the band were fantastic.
Drum Major Stan the Man Jackson, the old soldier, recalling the vagaries and crudities of military transport.
Anyway, we went out to this outside area and they said the bus is out there for you. So we all walk through with the band and everyone's got all, they're all carrying their instruments and I've got my gear. And we go through to where it was and I was with the director of music. And of course, the coach is waiting for us. Well, this coach, it had more bullet holes in it than the last stagecoach out of Dodge City. And the lads, like, their jaws dropped, and we got onto it. And it was just like a white rhino sort of thing. Just a normal bus up and down the street. The driver's come on. I don't think he spoke much English, if I remember rightly. But it's woo, 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 woo.
Major David Marshall, proud Cornishman and much-loved director of music, Coldstream Guards, reads from his diary.
Considerable farce then followed. With an acrid bus, it refused to start despite a push from a forklift truck and then a tow from a 432.
Stan the Man.
I remember as we were going along, we were all sort of looking at the blocks of flats, and on one side of the blocks of flats you'd see washing out and all the curtains were closed everywhere. And then the other half of the other side of the block of flats was gone. It was just rubble. And we were driving through on switching from one side of the dual carriageway to the other, and the tram lines that were above us, the electric all dangling down. So we're going round to miss them. And up the middle, like the central carriageway, where people were growing vegetables. And there was a guy, one of these guys was on there with us, and he was saying, they grow the veg, but they only come out at night to water it and pick it because of the snipers. Well, it was such an eye-opener for everybody.
Director of Music, Major David Marshall.
It was devastation all the way. Petrol station burnt out. and a high-rise block of flats, shelled and heavy fire damage, bullet holes everywhere. As we got nearer, the tramway had begun to run 2 days ago, and people were appearing in larger groups. Arrived at the stadium, with all programmes being changed by the minute. Conditions very grotty, no water, dark, just a hole for the toilet. The band unpacked and changed, ready to march on.
Former BBC chief correspondent Kate Adie recalls the arrival of some Yorkshire Norwegians.
We had skydivers as down they came, and there was a crowd. That did surprise us. It did give you a sense of confidence that something was changing. We'd never seen that sort of gathering in all of those previous years. Down came the skydivers, and somebody, as usual, some foreign journo said, "Who are they?" To which they were informed that they were Norwegian. At which point, as they came down, we scampered towards them. And as they said, it's the first time we met Norwegians with Yorkshire accents.
David Marshall.
Looking immaculate despite. Incredible feeling to march out in our finery to a city just only beginning to recover from siege.
And I remember going up through the Players' Tunnel, which reminded us of Wembley.
By the centre!
Take a word of command, a senior drum major, Stan Jackson, as the band plays Standard of St George. Kevin Coates, then band sergeant major.
The first march we marched onto is a march called the Peacemaker, and that's what all the papers picked up on. The first march out was the Peacemaker, which everything was meant to be. So that was right at the beginning, but the half-time display, we did a traditional guards display with guards on parade, and as it says in a lot of the papers, Glenn Miller in the Mood and Cockney Tunes. So that was the marching display we pursued with at the half-time. So we just got together, director and I chose some music, and out we went.
Thank you. King's the Peacemaker and Lawrence Wright's When the Guards Are on Parade, performed by the Band of the Coldstream Guards.
I think you ended up saying he is a general with clout. But it did look smart. It looked so different. I mean, everything was wrecked, sloppy. Nothing happened properly. The place was a ruin. So seeing, you know, that kind of precision marching and playing, my goodness, a different world, very much so.
Kate Adie remembers her impression of the day, and David Marshall reads from his journal.
Afterwards, while waiting for our transport, I gave the Mars bars away I had taken. I was promptly overcome almost by a dozen or so youngsters who tried to snatch these out of my personal belongings. I spoke to a Canadian freelance photographer, Jim Cooper, who said, "You must throw them on the ground, away from you." Past the Olympic ice rink that Torval and Dean had won their gold medals 10 years ago. Completely burnt out, but with apparently 1,000 people living underground in the cellar area. I was in the cockpit of the Herc for the takeoff out of Sarajevo and the landing into Split. I arrived back in Lineham at 21:30, home by 1:30 a.m.
Former Band Sergeant Major Kevin Coates.
Unique memory to take away with you. What would it be of that day?
I suppose we have to go back to our military background, and it's just the organisation of it. We knew what we were doing. You know, everything was pinpoint. We were worried about going into that zone. We were looked after. We were guarded. And it was just the whole organisation. But it was just the feeling of going there from the UK for a few hours, seeing the other side of the world, how bad it was then, and then going back home and being the safety of home the next day. Just unreal.
What effect do you think it had by your playing out there, the band going out there to lead out to the beginnings of this great football match between the United Nations and FK Sarajevo?
I think it brought a lot of uplift into the crowd. It was superb. You know, we knew that, and they couldn't get enough of us. They wouldn't let us off at half-time, you know, because they'd not seen a spectacle like that. Would you expect to see guys in scarlet tunics and bearskin in their war zone on a ground which is just devastated, you know? So there was a good feeling, and even, like I said, when we went outside to try and get on the vehicles, they were just mobbing us like the Beatles arriving at an airport. You couldn't get away from them, you know.
Yeah. General Sir Michael Rose.
You wrote that the football match was a reminder of a civilised and orderly world. Do you think that we could do that again, that Britain was a large part of that United Nations Protection Force? Do you think we could man that in the same way as we did then?
Well, I fear today we don't have the numbers, and as you know, our major centre of gravity now is defence of Europe in the face of the war in Ukraine. And all our resources are tied up in, quite rightly, in NATO, looking at the front line of NATO in Estonia, as it happens, where we have a major deployment going on at the moment. I just don't think we'd have the resources, either in terms of being able to fly them out in the RAF aircraft available, or indeed the political willingness to take that sort of a risk. I suppose we could produce a battle group for a major peacekeeping mission, but I think that would be about the limit.
But that's
I mean, in my day, we had three British battalions deployed at one point.
There's current reduced military strength. How do you think that affects our standing in terms of our sort of ranking?
Well, enormously, because, as you know, the Americans are now saying that we're now becoming a second-tier power, and unless we increase our numbers, the Navy, the Air Force and the Army, then we will they will always regard us as such, second-tier. And no longer equal partners in operation. And we can see that happening in the Red Sea at the moment.
Presidential candidate Donald Trump has said that recently we are on the brink of World War III. And going back to the significant role we played in Bosnia, and that the British Army since the 21st century has not known victory, only defeat. Do you think we would play an important role in any involvement or any conflict?
Well, I think we'd have to mobilise very, very fast. It'd be like the start of the First World War when we weren't really prepared. We had a small expeditionary force went to hold the line in France, and we ended up retreating in the Battle of Mons and other places and be almost driven back to the Channel before we were able to turn things around. And I fear it may be the case in the future. But I don't subscribe to the fact that we're on the edge of a Third World War. I mean, I think there's a kind of a hybrid war going on, but I think the Russians don't have the resources or the depth to be able to fight a Third World War. I think they know that as well as we do, that they are fully committed in Ukraine, and I think they've got a lot more firepower behind them.
You've been talking about peace and peacemakers, and we've mentioned Ukraine, but actually the world's eyes in terms of peace are on the Israel-Hamas war. Do you think that the United Nations and the United Nations peacekeeping forces could possibly be a solution to this?
Well, Kofi Annan, who at the time when I was in Bosnia was the head of the peacekeeping department, but then became subsequently the Secretary General, he used to say that the UN can do anything because, of course, it represents the collective will of the world. And if the collective will of the world determines something must be done and then produces the resources to do that, it can do anything, including fight wars successfully, as it has done in the past. Yeah. But if the United Nations is divided in its opinion and there are vetoes in the Security Council which won't allow action to be taken or the resources to be committed, then, of course, it becomes powerless. But if you take the war between the Israelis and the Gazans at the moment and Hamas, then of course it would make a very good peacekeeping organisation there if it was allowed to do what it needs to be done. But I fear that will never happen with the vetoes that America and Israel have. I fear that with our army down to falling down to what I believe will, given the lack of ability to recruit, etc., will fall down to 60,000. That is less than the size of the Royal Artillery when I joined the British Army in 1964. And so I think we really do need to build up our defence commitments, most of all the budget and our numbers. And we've also got to get rid of political correctness in the army, because political correctness never won a war.
On Monday, the 21st of March, 1994, the Times headlines proclaimed Guards Play for Peace in Sarajevo, accompanied by a large colour photograph of the band in bearskin caps and scarlet tunics marching into the Kosovo Stadium with Drum Major Jackson at their head. To paraphrase Edward Gorman, the newspaper's correspondent in the city at the time, barely in the nearly 300 years since it was formed, he wrote, has the regimental band of the Colchester Guards performed in such unusual circumstances. Major David Marshall reflects in the pages of his diary.
Monday. At least three of the major newspapers have extensive coverage of our visit. Front page on the Times, Independent and the Mail and Express inside. Part of my interview is quoted in the Times. After walking down to the paper shop, I sorted out some finances and after lunch went to the bank while Sherry did some shopping before Jill and Glenn arrived. Spent a pleasant supper and evening with them. Shirley's cooking, as usual, was delicious. Now, what I omitted to say was as I walked down, I was living in Farnborough at that time, I walked down to get a paper and that as well. It was brilliant sunshine. People were going about their everyday lives. And I just left what in effect was a war zone. Just a matter of hours before. It was such a thought-provoking, I suppose, contrast. One minute I was there living amongst civilians who'd had their homes, shell holes in their homes, in the flats, in these shells and bullet holes everywhere.
What can, as I recall, was it the ceasefire had only just come, and literally like a day or two before, maybe a week, but it was the fact that people were able to move. You couldn't move anywhere in Bosnia without the risk of being shot or blown up or coming under some form of bombardment.
I didn't realise that, Harry, and I didn't realise that until after, when General Rose said that if the Serbs had opened up on us, the Harrier jets would have taken out the... And I said, well, that's fine, tell them, that'd be too late for us.
Stan the man, Jackson.
You come back the next day. Did you expect yourself to be centre front of every single national and international newspaper across the world the next day, as you were?
Not really. No, the general had said, you know, you're going to get, there's going to be some big coverage about this. And I just took it with a pinch of salt. He thought, you know, a good flag to fly for peace. It's really good. And I was very, very happy and very, very proud to represent, along with the regimental band, along with all the lads who were all on there, all doing their thing, for us to represent the regiment, the British Army, and Britain as a whole. It was, you know, a matter of immense pride.
And my thanks to Kate Adey, General Sir Michael Rose, Major General Peter Williams, Lieutenant Colonel George Waters, Major David Marshall, former Band Sergeant Major Kevin Coates, former Drum Major Stan Jackson, Kath Mills and Neil Kernahan for their help in making this programme for the Army Benevolent Fund. But the last word goes to Kate Adey.
Peace in itself, two meanings, well, not meanings, two interpretations of it. One would be official agreements, political decisions, borders drawn, rules about this, that, and the other, and things parcelled out. That is peace agreements, which people often find extremely difficult to swallow, and not everyone agrees. But peace is also not being shot at, not having your family in a cellar under siege, and with God knows what going on outside. And there is no doubt that huge numbers of people needed that, and they knew it. And so having something so ordinary as a football match underlined what that was, going back to normal life, that it could be possible. I think that was its significance.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, then please visit General Talk's growing archive of previous editions at armybenevolentfund.org, where you can also learn about the important work the charity undertakes supporting our soldiers, veterans, and their immediate families. From me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening. Do join us next time. Until then, farewell. The excerpts from Cockney Tunes, Royal Standard and Milanello were played by the band of the Culture and Guards. With studio editing by Michael Siliano, this has been a Gamekeeper production for the Army Benevolent Fund.
That's my mug. That's my mug you're drinking from there.
Dan Jackson, I want my mug back.
Anyway.